Good morning, everyone. So today is our last class. I'm going to begin by just finishing up talking about energy and angular momentum in gravitational waves. So the sort of derivations here are a bit messy, but straightforward. So basically just kind of write down a couple equations and make a couple remarks about how one actually derives them. And then for the last part of the class, I want to talk a little bit about black hole perturbation theory and how you, or for example, calculate the gravitational waves that you would get from a perturbed black hole as it settles back down to a Kerr solution. So at the end of last class, we talked about how in order to calculate the energy and angular momentum that is in a gravitational wave, the idea is to basically take the Einstein field equations and expand them to second order in the metric perturbations. And so basically you get two terms. One term will be sort of the second order metric perturbation evaluated with the linear terms in the Einstein tensor. And then we can set those equal to -1 times the terms that we get by taking the first order metric perturbation and evaluating all the quadratic terms in the Einstein tensor. And basically we're gonna call that up to a factor of 8 pi, the stress energy tensor of the gravitational waves. And that gives us a metric tensor, it's conserved, it's quadratic in the first order perturbations. So one can basically go through that calculation, and the answer you arrive at is the following. Just means the trace and recall that we're sort of averaging everything over essentially, a wavelength of the gravitational waves. So in order to derive this, we basically just, plug through this expression for all the second order terms of the Einstein tensor. You also use the equations of motion. And then we're using this averaging fact, which kind of makes things simpler so that whenever, we have some gradient of a quantity, that averages to zero, and that also means that we can sort of use this to trade, like if we have a expression like this, we can use this to, we can basically use the product rule to trade the derivative when we do our averaging. But anyway, if you sort of apply all those things, then you arrive at this. So I haven't sort of gauge fixed h bar yet, but if we choose the transverse traceless gauge, you might notice that that's going to simplify quite a bit. So first of all, basically this term is zero in the Lorentz gauge, and then also if the trace is zero, then we get to drop this term as well. So the transverse traceless gauge, we just have the following expression. And so with this, we can evaluate a flux of energy and a flux of angular momentum, just in the same way we would for any other stress energy tensor. So we can calculate some energy density, for example, on a slice, just from the 0,0 component. And for a plane wave, if we evaluate that, we just get something like so where the omegas just come from these one for each time derivative. So you can see that sort of makes sense. That's proportional to the amplitude squared, proportional to the frequency squared of the gravitational wave. So that's the energy on some time slice. And then we can also calculate a flux of energy through some surface. Just the unit normal to our surface. We take some surface far away in the wave zone. And then similarly, we can do the same thing for the gravitational waves. Or sorry, the angular momentum of the gravitational waves. This is essentially just R cross P for this effective stress energy tensor. So here, this is just written in terms of stress energy tensor. But we could also take the quadrupole formula that we derived in class last time and try to use those to basically take the quadrupole formula that relates the quadrupole to h bar, and then plug those into this expression here, and then try to evaluate these expressions there. And so that's a straightforward calculation. Just get some surface integrals that you have to do. It's a bit tedious, but if you go through all that, you arrive at the following expressions. Should remember to evaluate this at the retarded time at the source. And then here, this is the reduced or trace-free part of the quadrupole moment. So we just take the quadrupole moment and we subtract out the trace. And we can do the same thing for the angular momentum expression. And so I believe earlier this week in the tutorial, you basically use these expressions for this for eccentric orbits, right? Yeah. And so, basically you can see that, in these orbits, they both carry away energy of the orbit and, angular momentum. They don't produce exactly spherical wave fronts. The gravitational waves carry away angular momentum as well.
What are the integrals over the surfaces again?
Yeah, this is just some surface at infinity, basically seeing how what the flux of gravitational waves is at infinity.
Are you using Stokes' theorem or something?
Well, this is just basically the definition of the flux of gravitational waves at infinity. Yeah.
And why is the average of the derivative of x is zero? Time average, right?
Yeah,
Is it time average zero?
yeah. Either you can think of it either time or a wavelength. Yeah.
Why is it zero?
That's just the like in the approximation we're taking. We're basically, we're not like as we discussed in class before. We're not trying to localize the gravitational wave energy to sort of something smaller than a wavelength. So basically, you basically can't say that. The energy in the gravitational wave is at the peak or the trough of the wave, or so we're averaging over a wavelength. So anything that kind of like oscillates over that is not going to contribute to this.
Oh,
But
okay.
anything that's kind of quadratic that doesn't average that over one wavelength will contribute.
Yes. Okay. I intuitively understand, but I don't understand of what order of magnitude this approximation is. Like, you're basically saying because you can't see the peaks and the troughs of the wave, you basically are averaging out everything. So you just then you're saying the average is zero. But for example, for the approximations that we had for the metric, I know that h, well, it's of order h, and h squared is of order h squared, but
Yeah.
this I don't know what order it is.
Yeah.
So
So
it's
we're
like.
basically, suppressing higher powers that are basically like the wavelength over our curvature scale. If that makes sense. So you have some background curvature. And then you want that background curvature length scale to be sort of small compared to your, or you want your gravitational waves to be
Gravitational
small.
wave small as opposed to the
Yeah.
curvature.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, that basically works as you go sort of sufficiently far into the wave zone. Right. But so, like, in some sense, if I didn't do this, right, then at each given time there'd basically be this cosine time dependence or something like that, right? If I had like an oscillating wave, right, and I've integrated it over a period of that, and in that sense, I get to drop all the terms that just average to zero over one period of the wave.
But you use that when you're writing TAB, right? You use the DAX, the time average is zero, to write the transverse traceless gauge
Yeah.
TAB.
Right, yeah. Or I think you have to use it again this one
Yeah,
anyway.
from that more into this line. I mean.
So to go from here to here, you just use the transverse gauge conditions that we have a Lorentz gauge and the trace is zero. But to get to this one, you have to use the averaging.
Okay.
Right. So otherwise you get other terms that would basically, once you average over a wavelength of the wave would go to zero.
Okay, sure. Let's see.
I mean, I've dropped them. That's
Yeah,
what
yeah.
they're not there. Yeah. Right. So any more questions about that before we switch gears a little bit and talk about black hole perturbations? So the sort of picture we have in mind is, say we have a black hole, and then we throw some matter into it, or we have two black holes and they come together to create a bigger black hole, but initially they're, it's distorted, and so it wants to settle down to the Kerr solution, which we think describes astrophysical black holes very well, and it'll sort of settle down by emitting some gravitational waves. We have some perturbations that decay. And so we basically want to talk about how one goes about calculating the decay of those perturbations. In particular, it will create gravitational waves that will emit as it settles down to a Kerr solution. So sort of doing black hole perturbation theory is, rather technical, and the equations are a bit complicated. So here I'm just going to kind of write down a couple of equations without deriving them, but sort of sketch the main ideas. So to make things simple to begin with, let's consider instead of a metric perturbation to a Kerr black hole, just a scalar field perturbation. So just a scalar a test scalar field on a Kerr background. And that'll basically have a lot of the same characteristic features as when we consider metric perturbations on the Kerr background. So if we write down the wave equation, just have the following. The box operator, and then here we're taking this to be just the Kerr metric, in our usual Boyer-Lindquist coordinates. So the name of the game today will be to choose sort of clever. Just as it's written down, this is a partial differential equation, right? Involves time and spatial derivatives of phi, and in general, that's quite complicated to solve. So what we'll be interested in is sort of choosing clever ansatz that will separate this partial differential equation into a set of ordinary differential equations, basically separating the time or the azimuthal or the angular, radial, and time dependence. So the ansatz we're going to choose for the scalar is the following. So we can separate out the radial dependence into some function capital R, the theta dependence into some function capital theta, the azimuthal dependence will just be given by some fixed azimuthal number m. And then we'll assume that we have some fixed frequency omega, or omega could in general be an imaginary number. So then if we take this ansatz, we plug it in here, we use our expression for the metric in Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, then it turns out this does separate. And we'll basically get two equations, one for the radial and one for the theta with some separation constant that connects the two. So it's similar to what you do for, say, the hydrogen equation when you solve the Schrodinger equation, the hydrogen atom. That's our radial equation. And then we get one for for theta. And so this lambda is our separation constant. And it appears here too. So first, if we just consider, instead of a curved black hole, a Schwarzschild black hole, we set a equals to 0. So this term disappears. Does that equation look familiar to anyone?
Hydrogen atom equation.
Well, particularly the angular part. So what's the solution to the angular part?
The ladder of spherical harmonics.
Spherical harmonics. Yeah. Yeah. So this is like the, I think it's called the, I guess the equation for the associated Legendre polynomials. And then if we multiply that by this e to the im phi, that gives us the spherical harmonics. So I just get the Legendre polynomials of cosine theta, and then these are just the spherical harmonics.
Are the capital deltas in the Bose equation the deltas in the metric, like the?
Yeah, those are the ones we remember from before. It's R minus R plus and R minus R minus. Yeah, and so what else can we say? So does anyone remember what the separation constant is for in the a equals zero case? Yeah, you know, there it's just L times L plus 1, where this L is the angular quantum number, if you will. Yeah, so that's just the A equals 0 case. When you don't have A equals to 0, you have a sort of generalization of the spherical harmonics, and those are actually called spheroidal harmonics. So sometimes people write them this capital S, but again, they can be labeled by these two angular numbers, L and M, and there's some function of cosine theta, but they're basically just dependent on this extra parameter, which is called the sphericity parameter C, and it's just this product of the black hole spin and the frequency that you can see shows up in that particular combination here. So in particular, these are the S equals 1 or our scalar spheroidal harmonics. So that kind of makes sense in the, because you know the black hole spinning, it's no longer spherically symmetric, and so we expect our angular functions to similarly be deformed.
So the spherical harmonic solution is actually for Schwarzschild.
Yeah. So the general solution of these spheroidal harmonics, and when C equals 0, the spheroidal harmonic is equal to the spherical. The spheroidal harmonic is equal to the spherical harmonic. Yeah. Yeah, so let's also just take a quick look at what our radial equation becomes when we consider Schwarzschild. And in that case, we can write it the following way. And here I'm introducing the so-called tortoise radial coordinate, you might recall from previous GR class. So that's related to the usual Bohr Lindquist radius in the following way. And the potential is given by, the sort of effective potential is given by this. And you can, you know, check that will go to, actually go to zero on the horizon. And you also might notice that in sort of the iconal limit, that's one where you assume L is much, much greater than one. This is actually similar to like the radial equation for photon orbits, which kind of makes sense that in the you know, high L iconal limit, the wave equation will act like a photon or move on null geodesics. So far we've basically been talking about constructing, or we basically figure out ansatz that will allow us to construct general solutions to the wave equation. You know, so to construct a general solution, basically just need, you know, this is sort of sufficiently complete that we can write any solution as a sum over all these, just in the following way. Sum over L's and M's, and then integrate over all the different frequencies. So this would essentially be the Fourier component of the frequency. And so for each, you know, given frequency and angular number, we'd have a different radial solution, and we'd also have a different angular solution. But in general, you could write any solution this way. But what we're interested in is not actually the general solution. So we're going to impose two set of boundary conditions that will allow us to construct what are called quasi-normal modes. So the first boundary condition is basically just we're going to require that everything be ingoing at the horizon. So that's basically, you know, demanded by irregularity or by the physics, since our causality. So for the in terms of this tortoise coordinate, for example, you can note that r going to 2m actually corresponds to the tortoise coordinate going to negative infinity, whereas r going to infinity also corresponds to r star going to infinity. So roughly that means that at the horizon, or as r star goes to minus infinity, this should just act like an ingoing wave. So that's just demanded by causality. But the second boundary condition that we're going to impose is that we only have outgoing radiation. So we don't have any radiation coming in from infinity. So that means at large distances, we should just have a radially outgoing wave. So this is different, for example, from you know, earlier in class we considered this, you know, super radiance example where we had some incoming wave and that would scatter out the black hole and produce an outgoing wave, and then you could compare the amplitude of the incoming and outgoing wave and see that you, for certain frequencies, could extract some energy. So there you have incoming and outgoing solution, but we're interested in just finding basically the solutions of some particular frequency that are ingoing at the horizon, but outgoing at infinity. And so it turns out that if you impose both these boundary conditions, that actually constrains you to consider a discrete spectrum of frequencies. Well, there are only specific frequencies that satisfy that condition. So this is, you know, familiar, for example, from the hydrogen atom, or when we talked about the super radiant stability. But yeah, basically because of these two conditions, you only get specific frequencies, and those are called the quasi-normal mode frequencies. You'll also see that written as QNMs for short. So they can be labeled by their different quantum numbers. So in addition to the angular numbers, we also have this overtone number, which basically you know, counts the number of nodes in our radial equation. And so you get a whole spectrum again. And so, for example, if you try to solve the, or if you search for these solutions to the radial equation that satisfy these two conditions, you'll get some spectrum that looks like this. Where, you know, in the complex plane, where here this is minus omega I, so going up way corresponds to modes that, so they're called quasi-normal because they oscillate with some real frequency, but they're also damped. And as you increase along this line, basically, and go to higher and higher overtones, they're damped faster and faster. So this oscillates with the real frequency, and then also exponentially decays with minus the imaginary frequency. And so basically the most relevant ones that we're interested in are these lower overtone numbers, because they're the least damped. So they're the ones that will sort of stick around the longest. So far we just talked about the scalar field equation, but actually this whole story sort of holds for metric perturbations as well. But the sort of really tricky thing that, you know, requires a clever trick to figure out how to do is this step where we sort of chose ansatz for our equation that actually separates the equation of motion for the perturbations. So if you just, you know, try to do that for the metric, you know, metric perturbation, it's, well, first of all, you have like a whole, you have, you know, all the degrees of freedom of a metric, but then if you just plug that in, the equations won't obviously separate in this nice way. So in order to put it in that form, we're going to have to introduce a couple of extra concepts. So the first idea, so basically instead of working with the metric directly, the trick that we're going to use is to work with the projections of the vial tensor instead. So I don't know if you've seen the vial tensor before, but it's sort of related to the Riemann tensor with some of its trace components subtracted out. So I'll just write down the definition of the vial tensor. So basically, we take the Riemann tensor, then we can write it as the vial tensor plus some extra pieces that depend on the Ricci tensor and scalar. And in particular, if we have a solution that satisfies the Einstein equations in vacuum, so it's the Ricci tensor is zero, then what's the relation between the vial tensor and the Riemann tensor? Yeah, they're equal. They're just the same. So instead of trying to work with, you know, all the components of the vial tensor, we're actually going to work with what are called the Neumann-Penrose scalars, which are basically projections of the vial tensor with a null tetrad. So a tetrad is just four vector fields that we can basically use to basically in lieu of choosing coordinates. And we can project, you know, any given tensor in terms of those that tetrad. So basically the idea is to use a tetrad that's suited to characterizing radiation. So the tetrad that Neumann and Penrose use, it's called LNM and complex conjugate of M. So L is basically, I think maybe I won't write down the expressions in Borel-Lindquist coordinates, but L sort of corresponds to an outgoing null vector. So you know, in flat space, it would just sort of be, t plus r, and then n would be the ingoing one. So that would just be t minus r, and then m in flat space would just be basically in the angular direction, and here you can notice it's a complex vector here. So basically, M and its complex conjugate will define two spatial, spatial directions. So basically, now we have sort of a complete basis, two null vectors and two spatial ones. So we can use these to define these Neumann-Penrose scalars. And the one we'll actually be interested in is called psi 4. So there's, you know, psi 0, 1, 2, 3. But it'll turn out that psi 4 is actually one that encodes the outgoing radiation. So that's just given by taking the Weyl tensor and then projecting it this way. And so, for example, if we look at a gravitational wave that's just, you know, just a propagating gravitational wave in the transverse traceless gauge and the wave zone, we can actually work out that if we plug this in, psi 4 reduces to this in terms of the projection of the metric perturbation with our null tetrad, or with our tetrad, or just in terms of the two polarizations. So basically, if we have psi 4, this complex number, it basically encodes the two different polarizations of our gravitational waves at infinity. But you'll notice that it's actually equal to two time derivatives of the metric, you know, which makes sense because we're constructing it from the Weyl tensor. So this, you know, is written in terms of second derivatives of the metric. Okay, so I'm not going to try to go through the equations or anything, but, you know, it turns out that if you write down the equation for psi 4, linearize on the black hole solution, then you actually, the equations do separate with the following ansatz, which will look a lot like the scalar case. So by the way, this, yeah. This row is just related to the radius this way. And so this S, I put a minus 2 here. So this is sort of the spin weight. This is the spin weight 2 spheroidal harmonic. So it's sort of a generalization of spheroidal harmonics to spin two fields. So you can compose a spin two field on the sphere this way. And this, well, maybe I should put a hat or a bar or something. Since R is a different radial function, obviously, than the scalar case. But again, it's just a function of the radius. But you get one solution for, you know, each particular choice of angular numbers and frequency. And so this, so basically, if you use this ansatz, then you, your metric perturbation equations decouple, and you get an ODE for R, and another one for that basically defines what this spheroidal harmonic is. And so this, these equations are actually called the Tucholsky equations. (Clears And so again, that's the sort of general solution. But if we're interested in quasi-normal modes, again, we want to look for solutions where we have an outgoing wave at infinity, and we have ingoing gravitational wave at the black hole horizon. And again, we'll find that there's only we get a discrete spectrum of quasi-normal modes. And then we can again label them by these, you know, overtone number and angular numbers L and M. And we'll get one for, you know, this will obviously depend on the black hole spin as well. So yeah, we're not gonna go through how one might you sort of numerically compute these quasi-normal modes. But if you do, it basically turns out that the least damped quasi-normal mode, the one with smallest imaginary frequency, or smallest negative imaginary frequency, is the L equals M equals 2 one. So oops. And it's the fundamental mode. And you know, if you compute the real and imaginary frequencies of this particular mode, sort of there's a nice empirical formula for it. So this is an approximation. So this is the real part of the frequency. And then we can also define a quality factor. So that's the ratio of the imaginary part of the frequency the real part of the frequency divided by twice the imaginary frequency. So basically a really big quality factor means that this wave will oscillate for many times before it dies down in amplitude, whereas a small one would mean that it's damped down in one or two oscillations. And so this, just empirically again, you can approximate this pretty well. So, for example, if we take an equal mass binary black hole and you merge it, you end up with a black hole that has a dimension of spin about 0.7. So if we plug in 0.7 here, we get the following numbers. That's about 0.53. And this is about 0.081. So you know, we can note that basically the oscillation frequency is sort of comparable to the, you know, the light crossing time of the black hole. So that sort of makes sense. We can also notice that the imaginary frequency is just, you know, sort of a factor of a few smaller. So this means that we'll basically expect to see a few oscillations, but these will be sort of quickly damped out. The oscillations to a black hole sort of are very quickly damped, again, on sort of light crossing time scales. You know, so if you see a gravitational wave signal from a black hole merger, so the two black holes will sort of have increasing amplitude and frequency as they come closer and closer together. At some point, you'll get a common horizon. You get the peak of the gravitational wave signal, and then they'll start to. You'll see this kind of exponential decay, and based on this, we expect a bit after the merger, it's going to be just dominated by the least damped quasi-neural node. And so we expect this sort of late frequency will map to this frequency here, and this decay time will map to this one. So basically, just by measuring this decay, that gives you a measure of the black hole mass and spin. And
can you explain the plot once more?
Yeah, so drawing here, basically the gravitational wave amplitude is a function of time for, let's say, a binary black hole merger. So you have the two black holes are circling each other, getting closer together. So the amplitude of the gravitational waves is increasing, the frequency is increasing. Then they get close enough, you get a common horizon. So you form a bigger black hole. And that black hole is a bit distorted, right? Because it's made from two black holes coming together. So that it wants to settle down to the Kerr solution. And it'll do that by oscillating and by creating gravitational waves. And basically, this is the mode that will live the longest as it oscillates. So that'll dominate it at least a little bit after it starts settling down. So this is the least damped quasi-neural mode, but there's a lot of interest actually on trying to just look at this ring downstage and measure like additional quasi-neural modes, so like overtone modes or different angular numbers, and you can imagine that sort of gives you a very clean test, or that both like helps you measure the black hole mass and spin, but also sort of gives you a very clean test of general relativity, in the sense that. For any given mass and spin, you should be able to compute the frequencies of all the quasi-neural modes. So if you were able to measure two of them, basically GR will give you a consistent GC check, right? Just one real imaginary frequency should tell you the mass and spin, and then if you measure other ones, you should know what they are. They should all be set by those as well. Yeah, and you can also sort of notice that as you increase the spin, this quality factor actually increases, which means that the modes are longer lived. And actually, in the extremal limit, that's where the black hole spin goes towards one, you actually have very long-lived quasi-neural modes. Okay, well, I think we're about out of time here. So yeah, let me just end there and ask if there are any questions either about this or anything else. Yeah, so I think your last tutorial is today, right?
Tomorrow.
Or tomorrow.
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
Yeah, and so you'll try to work out a crude approximation of what this waveform would look like, sort of using the quadrupole formula at the beginning and then attaching it to some quasi-neural mode at the end. sort of in reality, you know, for the in-spiral, people use what's called post-Newtonian theory. So they basically expand Einstein equations and V over C, so at the non-relativistic limit. And that's been done to very high order. And then, so that gets you the in-spiral, and then you can use black hole perturbation theory for the ring down, but then in the middle, that's when sort of you don't have a good approximation, and that's typically where numerical relativity comes in, so solving the nonlinear equations using computers.
Question, but then, like, for example, if you consider this merging binary situation, after the merger happened, like, is there a relaxation only via emitting gravitational waves, or could there be other processes, or are we just like interested in gravitational waves in general? Because in general, it's like a perturbation theory that they apply.
So I mean. So these quasi-normal modes are basically the perturbations that have only outgoing radiation, but I mean, they also have some component that's like ingoing at the horizon too. So it's not like that this quasi-normal mode corresponds to entirely to just gravitational waves being emitted. In some sense, it's like you can kind of think of these as like perturbations that sort of sit around essentially around the light ring of the black hole, and they're decaying by some of that. These perturbations are escaping to infinity where there are gravitational waves, and some of the perturbation is falling into the black hole. So yeah, it's basically a combination of the two. All right. Any other questions? Well, thank you all.